Okay, welcome everyone to a new episode of Fernostwärts. We're recording in Boston today on an extremely rainy day. And I'm very lucky and very thankful for Kiki Zhao to be with me here. Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Catherine. Nice to meet you. And to just give a little bit of background for people who don't know me, I'm currently a writer, independent writer based in China and the US. And for the past 2 years, I've been studying at Yale. And then before that, I worked as a journalist for 6 years out of the Beijing bureaus, mostly for the Financial Times and the New York Times as a full-time journalist there. And professionally, I'm currently associated with the Fairbank China Studies Center as an associate of research. And I'm interested in explore nationalism and how it's played out in China and in America and versus other countries.
So we actually sat down today to discuss specifically Chinese nationalism and I think also kind of some of the narratives that exist around nationalism in China today. And for starters, I would definitely recommend that people who are listening to this read Kiki's writing on this, and we'll link to this. You wrote an introduction to a newsletter for Chinese storytellers,
right?
Which is a group of journalists born in China. Is that?
Yeah, the Chinese storytellers were founded by several friends of mine in New York. Well, most of the people. Members and the founders, they were born in China and then grew up in China, but then many of them, they have studied journalism or communication or related subjects in the US or other Western countries, and then they are trying to do journalism in international media, and many of them, they have had experiences being journalists, reporting and writing for international media already.
And so we will link to that. And you also wrote an interesting article for Chinafile about like the diversity of voices that existed within China on the question of Hong Kong and how that easily gets like subsumed or hidden when people just talk about how there is like one nationalistic Chinese narrative. So I think for starters, I think people probably aren't very familiar with what it's like to grow up in China. And I think people sometimes have like maybe only a vague conception of what it's like to grow up in a country that does have internet censorship. And so do you think that, did that influence like you, or do you think that influences people? And to what extent do you think was politics part of your education?
Right, and I think I can start to talk about my personal interest in politics, and then how looking back, I'm also just trying to wrestle with myself, like when did I become interested in politics, and then what was my particular political ideas were at a certain age. But then unfortunately, you know, the evidence I could find from my writings as a child suggest that I wasn't a very political child until probably after I graduated from college. Well, and then one particular thing that was actually an essay I wrote that my mom found and she sent it to me, and she made a comment. She said, It looks like you know, you had this sort of strong patriotism spirit when you were little. I'm like, what? And so I looked at the essay, and so the essay, yes, after I read it, you know, I wrote it when I was elementary school student. I think I wrote the essay in 1996 or 1997. I couldn't really remember exactly, but then the whole essay was about how as pupils, we should think independently and not buy these textbooks that provide answers for some of the schoolwork. Mm-hmm. There was a paragraph there in which I specifically wrote, because only, you know, we work hard and we think independently, can we, when we grow up, we can help to build our country. I think looking back, that kind of wording and writing definitely was in a way inspired by the larger narrative that you would often hear from maybe China Central Television and all that. But looking back, do I think I was being brainwashed as a child? I don't really think so, because I feel like personally, when I was a child, even when I was a teenager, I just like politically, I wasn't very much interested in anything political at all, I could say. And then even when I was in college, I just wasn't very much interested in exploring the larger political questions. And I think as a teenager, definitely, I just felt I was too young at the time to exploring a lot of different political topics. But one thing that I still remember that happened when I was in high school was, so in high school, I think either when I was a freshman or a sophomore in high school, I didn't, well, in an exam session, I didn't answer the politics paper. And then I got to score 0. And then the teacher was pretty mad because he considered me to be a quite good student. And then, so he told this to my mom, and my mom basically just shrugged it off. And the reason I didn't answer that politics paper was because, you know, actually I felt, looking back, probably started since I was a junior high school student, and definitely when I was a high school student, I feel like any person in China or a Chinese teenager even with some sort of independent thought would figure that a lot of the things that you read from the textbooks, the politics textbooks, don't really make a lot of sense, and they're boring as well. So you're just naturally, you're not drawn to that. And then, so on that day, I just decided, oh, I'm not interested in this, and I don't plan to study politics in the future.
Just on that, also just like a two things, I think that's also, it really echoes a lot of things that I've heard from when I used to teach at a Chinese high school for a year, and a lot of the kids I taught were like, I hate politics, it's so boring. And then later my friends told me, oh, politics is just kind of, you talk about Marx and whatever, and you talk about like a lot of theory. So that's also like, when they talked about politics, they meant like a very particular thing that also was extremely boring.
Yes.
And I think another thing that's also worth bearing in mind is that it's easy to think that if you hear particular things from the government, I think the narrative in the West is often you hear these things and people believe it, but there's actually, I can link to the study, but there's at least one research paper where the author finds that actually people who know the propaganda very well are actually more critical of the government. Because people realize that it's really boring and kind of pointless.
Yeah.
And just being good at repeating that and regurgitating that doesn't mean that you believe it. So I will link to that research paper as well.
Yeah, I think that's a very real sense, I would say. And also I can confirm to what you have just said just by looking back of some of my, you know, teenage years essays or looking back how I responded to these politics classes that I absolutely hated at the time. But then I do think that now looking back at those time that I had to take these politics classes, I would consider it's a waste of time after all. You know, as a teenager, you would want to spend more time studying things that you're more interested in. But, you know, you are sort of required to take this classes on politics. But then definitely it doesn't mean that, oh, you're being brainwashed just after repeating all these lines from these politics books.
Yeah. Do you think that, so there's a lot of talk about how Xi Jinping has made China more nationalistic by kind of amping up the nationalistic rhetoric. And you also mentioned that in one of your writing. Like, what's your impression of, has that gotten stronger? Or is there more pressure now to be more to adopt kind of like nationalistic points of view? Has the pressure gotten stronger compared to when you were younger?
It's very hard to answer that question because I think when I was younger, it was also the time when we don't really look at social media and trying to gather people's opinions. And now I think one of the things especially journalists tend to do is they look at social media and then they think oh, the social media present a certain picture of, in the case of China, like how Chinese nationalism is playing out or how American nationalism is playing out. I think in the case of China, it can be misleading in that, I think I mentioned this in my China Fire article, because it's very hard for people to gauge what portion of this hyper-nationalistic messages were actually sponsored by the state. And also it's hard to gauge, even if it's a real, I believe that there are people, there are real people who are hyper-nationalistic and who tend to lash out even these hyper-nationalistic messages online. But then in terms of what does that exactly mean? Does that mean that these kind of people or groups of people would do something harmful using the nationalistic guise in real life? It's very hard to say, because we all know that people tend to say something outrageous online. And then it's also, you know, if you see other people are making similar comments, maybe you feel emboldened of making the similar kind of comments. But one thing I would comment on, you know, your question about how things have, whether I feel it is worse under Xi. I think what we have seen, especially in light of the Hong Kong protest, there's definitely a concerted effort from state media trying to drum up a certain nationalistic rhetoric, which in my opinion can be very dangerous. Because, you know, looking back, I think last time in 2012, there was the anti-Japanese protest. One of the most famous cases resulting from that protest was there was this person in Xi'an, a northwestern Chinese city, who was driving a Japanese branded car that was actually made in Tianjin, if I remember it correctly. But then they were just this group of mobs under the guise of being nationalistic, or, you know, I don't even want to use the term patriotism, because it is not. It is definitely a group of mobs who were emboldened by this nationalistic rhetoric. And then they beat up this Chinese driver. And then he ended up just being paralyzed. Actually, a Chinese journalist, Jiang Xue, she wrote a very good article in Chinese. Unfortunately, it hasn't been translated into English. The Chinese language media platform Inisham. Maybe Catherine can have a link to that as well.
Yeah, we'll link that in show notes.
Yeah, so I think the state is definitely trying to, the state media is trying to drum up this nationalistic rhetoric. But I think what is hard to know is who in this state medias had these ideas of carrying out this particular nationalistic, hyper-nationalistic articles and rhetoric, and why they're doing it. Are they just doing it to please their superiors? And that is something is really, really hard for journalists or China watchers to know. I think that's very frustrating. And then that actually reminds me of a paper that I think it came out in 2015, was written by Jessica, sorry, I forgot her name. She's teaching now at Stanford. She was studying at Harvard at the time.
Jennifer Pan?
Jennifer Pan, yes. So the paper was co-written by Jennifer Pan and another, I think, Harvard professor. And I recall reading that paper. I think Catherine could find it and link to that paper. It probably came out in 2015, around that time. And they have a conclusion of looking at a lot of the deleted posts from Weibo. And they worked with some computer scientists. And their conclusion was that at the time that on studying Weibo censorship, the Chinese government would censor posts that they think could result in group gatherings. Mm-hmm. But then if you just publish something that is very critical about the Chinese government, they probably wouldn't delete it, because the government also want to keep these platforms as a way to gauge the public sentiment. So I think that's also important to remember, that this sort of online nationalism that we have been seeing I think there are different state actors in the state media or in government, and different people are having different motives of drumming up particular kind of nationalistic rhetoric. Mm-hmm. And then I think from the evidences from these papers, and the Chinese state might be worried about, you know, even in the name of nationalism, what if there are large groups of people gathering? And then that is something that the Chinese government has been worrying about a lot, and as we've seen, from Jennifer Pan's paper.
There's also, I think the work by Jessica Chen Weiss is also really interesting in this regard, because she wrote an entire book about how there is nationalistic protest in China, but the government can be very deliberate about when it allows this protest, right? When it allows the protest to happen. Because if there's a large group of people out in the streets, whether they're protesting against the government or against Japan, ultimately in both cases it's kind of hard to control.
Right.
Because the moment you have like a large group of people out on the streets, like you might not be able to contain what's going on. So that's like a similar conclusion essentially also to the pen paper. I also wanted to come back to because we were already talking about kind of like online conversation. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering whether you could also talk a bit about your research on that you did for the China File article, where you write about some of the different voices that are out there on Chinese media, on Chinese social media, specifically on Hong Kong.
Right. I think in the case specifically on Hong Kong, you know, the Hong Kong protest has been ongoing for, I think, 3 months or more than, is that more
than four months,
I think,
now. At this point.
At first, a lot of international media started to report on mainland reactions to the Hong Kong protests and mainlanders' reactions of the Hong Kong protests. And then many of the articles I actually pointed out in my China File piece tend to have this simplified black and white picture, in that they paint the Hong Kong protesters as pro-democracy, and then on the other hand, they paint their mainland Chinese peers as this people who are brainwashed and who are anti-democracy. And I think I had a pretty good explanation in my China File article, even for some of the other articles that are trying to explain a little bit more some of the mainland Chinese people who have access to outside information, outside the Great Firewall, who have access to read international media, they are also against Hong Kong protest. And then we all know now that 4 months probably into the protest, and this narrative have been debunked already. But I think in the particular case of gauging mainlanders' sentiment or reactions to Hong Kong protests, and similarly engaging other political ideas from mainlanders, a very hard part is, I would say, as a reporter, how do you report on something that is silent? How do you report on this silent space? And I think for a lot of people who have experiences of growing up in a somewhat authoritarian public space or authoritarian country, people know a lot of things privately and they discuss a lot of things privately. But then, you know, they probably don't really write an article to say, like, "Dong the Chinese Communist Party," things like that. So especially, you know, on the case of Hong Kong, we've already seen reports. One of the report from the Wall Street Journal by Fan Wenxin wrote that they are mainlanders who went to participate in the Hong Kong protest. And then, the risk that they're facing is they might be detained or jailed after they go back to the mainland. That's one of the things people need to really keep in mind, that no one should stand on a higher moral ground and criticize the mainlanders of not having a view that they want them to have on the Hong Kong protest. I mean, even the people in Hong Kong, they have very diverse views on the Hong Kong protest. So I think to summarize it, I don't have an answer to it, but I've been actually thinking a lot in journalistic reportings and in these very sensitive and topics, how a journalist could write this voices that are essentially silent voices, but then they're actually there. How do you report on that? I don't have an answer. And then you mentioned the China Fire article. It was actually, I wrote it in the haste and I didn't have a lot of resources, to be honest, at the time. And then when I wrote it, I was in the States. And then when it was published, I was in China. You know, privately, actually, I had a lot of conversations with mainlanders and people in Hong Kong. But then a lot of these conversations, they are off the record. And I can't put anything either in that article or into another article. So that's very frustrating. But then even when I was looking at Weibo, I think Weibo is still a place, although it has been heavily censored, it's still a place for me to sometimes gauge these different ideas. For example, I recall I was trying to even convince my China file editor, you know, she was like, oh, you know, like, what are the proportion of these people who have these other different thoughts? I'm like, I don't know. It's frustrating. I don't know how to gauge this. But then, you know, I recall one of the examples I used to convince her was that some people wrote some tweet. That was actually when I wrote it, that was in August, late August. That was maybe one month, actually.
Yeah.
A little more than 1 month into the protest. And at the time, the protest was still like largely peaceful. And that was shortly after, I think a month after the attack in Yuanlong, in Hong Kong. And then I saw people posting on Weibo. There were a lot of people were very supportive and sympathetic towards the Hong Kong protest. And many more people who don't really know what is going on are trying to understand. And I think that is really important. People who don't understand what is going on are trying very hard to understand what is actually going on in Hong Kong. And then one thing that touched me a lot was, you know, I mentioned Xu Xibai, whom I actually ended up interviewing. He's really amazing. He was just trying to provide a lot of good information. And then he had a post that introducing these books on the history of Hong Kong. And then people were just retweeting that tweet. I was very touched personally. I'm like, yeah, like when you don't understand what is going on, and then many people are trying really hard in China, mainland China, understanding what is going on. And also another thing I was trying to convince my editor at the time was also inspired by all these other amazing people voicing their voices on Weibo is I recall seeing someone saying, I actually mentioned it in my China file piece, that, you know, when the censorship is so strong, the censorship was very strong in those times in, you know, regarding Hong Kong, which was very unfortunate. And then one person wrote that, you know, something like in such times, and then when you upvote a post, that's like your silent support. Oh. I'm like, oh, that's, when I read it, it's touching for me. You know, a lot of times people are worried. I don't want to just write something and then get my whole Weibo account censored or disappeared. Or other times, I think people are a little pessimistic because they're like, what's the point of writing anything, even if I know what's going on in Hong Kong and what I write will be censored on Weibo? But then still, they're just constantly, people are trying to transfer information that they see in Hong Kong media, for example, in other good Chinese media platforms, or good news articles reported by the international media back into China and back inside the Great Firewall. And they're constantly trying to do that, defy censorship, and that they're constantly, a lot of these posts, they have like tens of thousands of upvotes sometimes even. That's quite touching for me to see.
I also, yeah, I think just for people who maybe are not that familiar with Weibo, it's a bit like Twitter, so it's comparable, I would argue.
Yeah.
And are we also going to link to, because Xibai Xu is also on Twitter, actually, so we can also, for people who are not on Weibo, we can also link his Twitter account.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons the article was very much going around is that it was one of the first looks at somehow like how there is a conversation going on even within China. And I really think the thing that you're talking about, this thirst for knowledge and that people want to know and understand what's happening, that's something really important that was missed before, maybe, in how people were discussing this topic.
Right. And then also just on the Hong Kong topic, I can share something personal as well, because when the article was published, I was actually in China, and then I went to visit my uncle. So I have an uncle who lived in this small village in northeastern China near the Russian border, not too far from it at least. And then, you know, he doesn't read English. He didn't go to college, and he lived in this small village, but he likes to talk about politics, and he's 70 something now, and he likes to talk about politics all the time because he has nothing better to do, right? And he watches the Chinese central television all the time. And then so I asked him, I became curious. I'm like, hey, what do you think of Hong Kong? You know, the Chinese central television is having all this news piece about writers and such. And then he said, yeah, I watch the news from Chinese central television. But you know, every time when they say like the students are protesting about something, you know, something's not right. I'm like, yeah, and that's just, you know, like a lot of Chinese people, I would even have this sort of arrogant personal opinion, like, oh, my uncle, who's 70-something, lives in this small village. He knows shit about Hong Kong, probably, right? And he doesn't even read a lot of news articles. He just watches TV all the time. And then even he knows that, oh, when students are protesting against something, then something's not right. That kind of... I think comment just made me think, reflect a lot on my own arrogant opinions or biased opinions about people. And then I think that's also a reminder for me personally, just not to assume what other people would think or not, and how politically savvy another person is just based on that person's exposure or background.
I think that's also a really important point, because I think a lot of the research also that looks at how Chinese people get information about the news looks at whether they use a VPN. And so we do know that people who get VPNs to access websites outside of the Chinese Great Firewall are primarily middle class and have like a good income. And so I think the implicit assumption is often that people who are middle class and well educated will be better informed. But like you're saying, it's not necessarily true. Like you can get information even without a VPN. And also I think a lot of people in China, I still encounter a healthy skepticism that a lot of people have towards like media, and like your uncle, they start looking for other signs.
Yeah, I think also just my uncle's story, there's, you know, just growing up in China, I feel like I have a pretty good grasp on just how these normal, ordinary people who haven't gone to college or who don't necessarily have a very good educational background, who don't use VPNs to look at news outside, but they have this distrust of what they see in the state media, because that's the life they live, and that they see. So they have this, you know, very cynical sense of distrust of the news that they see from state media, first and foremost. And that's very important to remember as well. And then another thing, I think, just to commenting on the Hong Kong case specifically. And one thing I've been trying to tell other journalists who interviewed me is like, you know, there are a lot of mainlanders, and then many mainlanders, they haven't even been to Hong Kong because they are not so well off that they can just travel to Hong Kong very easily. And then it's very unfair that you have to ask these people, so what do you think of the Hong Kong protest? So what are they supposed to think? They're not thinking of anything about the Hong Kong protest because it's just too... It's too far away a thing of their concern just going on about daily lives for these people.
I think that's a really important point. It's, I think, something where, like for me, I think I think Chinese people, just as people anywhere else, I think have a right to just not have an opinion on politics.
Yeah.
Like, I think a lot of Germans also are probably not interested in politics and don't have an opinion on stuff. And if you go and ask them, like, what do you think about like German foreign policy in the Middle East? They probably look at you and go like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And I think similarly, that is also just completely legitimate. And it's, I think, also very understandable that a lot of people have other problems. Also, just another thing that I just remembered, it's also worth, because there's a lot of talk about censorship often abroad in China. It's also worth noting that the post specifically by Xi Baishu is actually still up on Weibo, I think. So it's not like that stuff is up for like a day and then gets censored or something. Like a lot of that information is still out there.
Yeah, I mean, just based on my personal engagement of the Chinese social media or the Chinese website and personal observation and professional observation as well, I definitely think maybe after a month or so into the Hong Kong protest, Chinese censors have been working very hard to censor a lot of news about the Hong Kong protest. When it first started, when it was largely just very peaceful, there was absolutely nothing about the Hong Kong protest. I think on this, a lot of the international media have reported on that turn already. One other comment I do want to make is that I feel media professionals and especially journalists look into the online censorship. Of course, they need to look into online censorship. But I would say lots of people, if you look at China, a lot of people, they get their information from books as well. Mm-hmm. And many people, they do read books. I think it's probably pretty common that, you know, today people would also lament in America that, oh my gosh, people don't read books anymore. Well, it's pretty true. And then if you go to the Chinese subway, it's the same thing. Like, people look at their phones all the time. But even with that, I think a lot of the people looking at their phones in China inside the Great Firewall, there are a lot of still very good Chinese news articles that, you know, foreign journalists just tend to overlook. Mm-hmm. And then another point is a lot of people, they read books, and then many of these books, you know, when you read them, you would be very surprised. You will be saying like, oh, if this book is, the information here is up online, they would have been censored, but they're still there in bookstores.
Can you think of an example?
Right now, I mean, I can't really think of a particular book. Maybe I can think of, what's the name of that book? The book written by the French guy, Democracy Tocqueville? Is that how to pronounce his name?
Oh, Tocqueville, who wrote about America?
Yes.
He has like this whole thing about like how great American democracy is.
Yeah, like Democracy in America, for example, you would think, oh my gosh, if this is an article talking about democracy in America, it would be censored on the Chinese website. But the book is still there. The book was translated, I think, in the 80s or something. Uh-huh. And then people love reading that kind of books. And there are plenty books talking about politics and then this thoughts, you know, you can go and buy Plato's books translated into Chinese and read that. And I think on that note, you know, I actually wrote a short piece that hasn't been published, in which, you know, I was talking about my mom, and she just loves reading books, and, you know, we talk a lot. And actually, one time I asked her, and she doesn't use a VPN because she doesn't read English news or anything. So I asked her, I'm like, what do you think of this Chinese censorships? And then all these people are saying that maybe Chinese people are brainwashed because they don't have access to outside information. And what my mom is saying, like, well, it just saves me time for not looking at the internet that often, so I can have time to read books. You know, it's I definitely don't, that's not a common man to justify the online censorship. But I'm also saying that I feel journalists have been paying too much attention about online censorship while largely ignoring that a society is very porous. And when you look at this large society, there are a lot of people, like I said, in China, like just my mom, you know, she didn't even go to college, and they read all these books and to understand things about either China or the outside world.
You mentioned earlier, and I think some of the stuff that you were just talking about also speaks to that, about how hard it is to report on silent voices and about people who are not writing online or like writing articles or posting on Weibo. Have you seen any reporting that you thought did a really good job at kind of like getting at those silent voices?
I definitely think so. But then I think, unfortunately, at this stage, a lot of these reports are in Chinese. Mm. Like, I can immediately think of several of the Chinese news websites or WeChat public accounts that publish very good contents in Chinese. For example, this video platform called Jianchang, I think it might be translated as Arrow Factory or something. It is, you know, it produces these short videos about ordinary Chinese people's lives. It's absolutely fascinating. I recall recently watching one video about a person in northeastern China, I think in Shenyang, if I remember correctly. This person was jailed in prison for a long time, and after he came out, he became like 入监师, how to say that? Like, you help dead people to clean, you clean up the corpse.
Oh.
Anyhow.
Undertaker and in English, maybe?
I don't know how to describe that. I don't know the English word. Anyhow, so it's basically, so this person picked up a new job of transforming himself to clean up the corpses because, you know, it's the kind of job that other people don't like to do. And then he set up a network of helping other previous inmates who came out of prison and who find it hard to find jobs. You get this kind of story. And I like that kind of story. Mm-hmm. And then another Chinese news platform, well, not news platform, another Chinese actually story platform, I would say. It's called Nuan Story. I really like it as well. It also tries very hard to tell the personal stories of more like ordinary Chinese people. Mm. Because I think very often when we look at the international headlines, we tend to look at the high politics and we tend to look at government policies and then relationships between two governments or multiple governments. But then it's very often it's a top-down look of the society. But then in that, I think what is sorely missing is this this look from the grassroots and how things are happening on the grassroots levels and how individuals' life are being affected by, of course, their lives are being affected by the larger political policies and the environment and geopolitics. But then, you know, they also have a lot of their own agencies. And then I think these Chinese news platforms were trying very hard to tell just their stories from their perspectives to restore their own agencies. I think that's a very powerful thing to do.
Yeah, I think those are really good examples. I'll ask you for the links later. And so just in case some of our listeners understand Chinese or want to put those stories into Google Translate and see what comes out, we should totally link to them.
Sure.
I also just wanted to, since we started off the conversation talking about nationalism, I wanted to pivot kind of back to that a bit, because there's been some discussion about nationalism, especially amongst students who come abroad. And I think one common, the way the story goes is often, there's often pictures of Chinese students who, for example, protest with like big Chinese flags and who are nationalistic or patriotic. Sometimes it's violent, but not always. And I think one question that I often get in, for example, Germany, is people then are asked like, oh, how can people still be supportive of China if they see, if they hear now hear all the bad things? Now they have access to free media. Now they know, why do they still support their country? Mm-hmm. Or why do they support their government, I think is the big question.
Right. I would say that kind of view is too simplified, the black-white view. And then I've been very careful personally of making comments about this overtly display of nationalism among the overseas Chinese, either students or Chinese immigrants groups, because, you know, I want to know the specifics first, whether some of these events are organized by Chinese embassies with clear political agendas. And then I have yet to see, as far as I can recall, any detailed report about that. You know, are any of the government actors involved in this overtly displayed nationalism sort of events? And that's one thing. And another thing I think that tends to get overlooked in these simplified narratives is that sometimes, just from reports I gathered, you see Chinese, overseas Chinese students or overseas Chinese immigrants, they gather under the Chinese flag. And then in that, I feel sometimes media tend to inflate nationalism and patriotism. And then I feel a lot of these people, while I haven't reported on any of these events and I haven't spoken with these people, but then just from the reports I gathered and my conversations with other mainlanders, I think a lot of times when people display the Chinese flag, they do have this sense of very genuine patriotism sentiment, which is very natural. You know, people ask me, what do you think of patriotism? I would say, Well, I grew up in China, so I know that place. And then I have family members of very different backgrounds. And then I have friends of very different backgrounds as well. So they are very... So I see a lot of faces when I see... when every time this kind of very large political loaded words are mentioned, such as nationalism, such as patriotism. And I would consider... you know, patriotism is a very genuine sentiment if you want to, you know, the sort of genuine sentiment that you want to improve a community you are familiar with into the better. And I think it's unfortunate that when a lot of international media are reporting on these events, they mistake this kind of genuine patriotism as nationalism, or they just simply dismiss it because they think all these Chinese people should be against the Chinese Communist Party. That's just too simple a narrative, and I personally don't want to buy into that narrative. But on the other hand, as I said earlier, are any of the state actors with clear political agendas involved in any of this? And I'd like to see that kind of reports as well. Yeah. And also in several of the cases, reports I've seen are, you know, they involve some of the Chinese people, Chinese nationals, or I don't know if they are Chinese nationals now, actually. You know, they hurl all these insults as people who supported the Hong Kong protests, for example. And then in a few cases, you know, the sort of languages they use are definitely, I would characterize as almost cultural revolution style kind of languages. So that's quite alarming to me. And I'm not exactly sure how the local communities will address these issues, because it's also an issue of, you know, it is an issue of exercising your rights of freedom of speech. But then legally speaking, if these people in a democratic society haven't crossed the legal line, should they be punished? Legally, they should not be punished, right? But then again, how state actors are involved, that needs to be, I think that need to be unearthed by journalists and other people who are looking into these cases.
Yeah, I think there's been some reporting that like indicates that there's been some involvement of embassies. I think there was one case in Canada where there was some relatively, there were screenshots of messages between a Chinese student organization and an embassy. But I think so far, that's like one of the very few cases that I've heard of where there was pretty concrete evidence of organization by government actors. I think that's a very good point. I was also wondering, because you also talk about how, like, there's the sense of patriotism, and when somewhere is your home, then you have an interest in making that place better, right? So do you think, we hear a lot about Chinese development over the past few decades. Do you think that matters as well in people feeling like proud? Because living conditions in China have changed rapidly and many things have improved in terms of material well-being over the past few decades. Do you think that plays a role in how people feel?
I think that plays a role in that the government, the official Chinese government narrative or the official Chinese state media narrative, they frame things in that way. And of course, they have a very clear political agenda, I would say. And then for this, it actually reminds me of a debate between Eric Lee and Yasheng Huang, an MIT professor. And it's up on TED Talk. I think people who are interested in this, and Catherine could provide links of, these two people have a pretty famous and good debate about who exactly was responsible for the development of the Chinese economy. And then I think maybe I could provide some of my personal experiences in that I have very different ideas. Well, not very different. I have some maybe ideas that are different even from some of my family members. And, you know, some of them or friends would definitely credit the Chinese Communist Party for making China richer and develop better. Well, I think these arguments need to be looked by academics and people who study this development policies very closely, because I think at the core of it, you are also looking at what sort of role a state or a party, and especially in the case of China, the party state, what kind of industrial policies that they have been able to implement it that have really played a role of alleviating poverty. Mm. I think that's an academic question. I would like to see more of, you know, I didn't specifically study this kind of industrial policies in modern China's development, so I don't feel like I can really comment on that. But I think it's really important to get the specifics right, and not to just making sweeping generalizations, either about the Chinese Communist Party or, you know, trying to, when we are trying to talk about this, who is really responsible for bettering China's economic growth. And I would definitely think that one comment I can make is a lot of the people who have been doing the most humble jobs, they didn't gain enough credit that should be given. Like a lot of the migrant workers, construction workers and nannies and migrant, you know, like, they built the bridges, they built the buildings, and then delivery workers even. And, you know, they, most of the time they were paid little compared to other office workers. And then if anyone asks me about China's economic miracle, I definitely would want to play these people into the center of the story.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. So because we were talking about nationalism earlier, like amongst Chinese students, do you think it's a factor that Chinese students, when they come abroad, often encounter foreigners who know very little about China or who have a specific view of China that has very little to do with the reality on the ground?
I think that definitely happens. But I think on the other hand, if you, you know, as you are from Germany, for example, and if you go to China, you ask someone about their ideas about Germany and the German people, you would probably get a lot of interesting answers as well. It's people all in all different places, they all have assumptions about another place and group of people they are not familiar with. And then it's, I feel like it's just human nature to make these sort of generalizations, because it is true that certain societies in a certain place and location and time, they have some sort of social norms that reflect in, and to outsiders, and to see, oh, this is these groups of people tend to do this kind of thing. But then often, you know, in the case of China, I think unfortunately, we often see the kind of black and white reports about politics on international media. That's probably why some of the, you know, the Chinese students you talked about get a little defensive when they come to study abroad. And then because, well, I don't have any personal experiences of encountering any Chinese students or Chinese person abroad of like being irrationally nationalistic about defending some of the obvious wrong things that the party was responsible for. So that's just my personal experiences. It might has a lot to do with the certain groups of people I hang out with. But then I think it's really, you need to look at the specifics. Mm-hmm. And then I recall one example. I once read a story written by a mainland Chinese student in talking that he or she just felt was so offended when people assume that, oh, you're from China, so you must eat dog meat. You know, that kind of thing. I think it's pretty natural for anyone to feel a little uneasy, I guess. Well, I guess maybe as they grow older, they can just laugh it off. But then I think on the other hand of the story, it is also very true that especially in today's heightened political environment, there is a tendency for international media and for some of the journalists to even demonize the Chinese people as a whole. So that's quite dangerous.
Yeah, I agree. Do you have anything that you wanted to add or anything that I forgot to ask about, maybe? Or also, if you have nothing, no comments to add, because I'm out of questions, then
oh.
if you have any recommendations for maybe like platforms or authors that you think might be good people to follow? I personally would definitely recommend people follow the Chinese Storytellers newsletter. Mm. Do you have any recommendations beyond that on especially the topics that we talked about?
Well, I do think a lot of the good reportings, they still come from the Chinese media, regardless of the fact that, you know, there are a lot of topics that are political taboos that they cannot really report on. Mm. But still, you know, I follow several dozens of WeChat public accounts, and they have all these very interesting stories about just the daily lives about China. For example, this other WeChat account I like to read often is called Guoke. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to translate it into English. It's specifically about a lot of the science topics, but it's written in a very funny millennial way, and then it has a very large readership. I think for people who are not familiar with China and have not lived there and visited, definitely the country as a whole have changed very drastically in the past 70 years. You know, it's a cliche to say already. But then I think one useful tip maybe I can give to anyone who wants to understand China, it's just to think that people are more similar than they are different. I think that's very important to remember. And also in this particular case, you know, today's topic, we're talking about nationalism and some of the internet censorship. One thing I really wanted to point out, which I actually wrote it on Twitter a few weeks ago, is that American companies have played quite a role in helping the Chinese government of setting up and solidify the Great Firewall. And people should look at the controversy, you know, the whole case of Cisco that has been very controversial. And another case I pointed out, I actually wrote it on Twitter, was also that Yahoo, an American company, shared its email information with the Chinese authorities. And then the Chinese authorities, using that information, actually jailed a Chinese journalist, Shi Tao, for several years, and people can look up that information as well. So what I'm trying to say with this information is that it's just simply wrong to assume a higher moral ground to judge other people's morality or to judge other people's intellectual capabilities. And then it's also, you know, the world, it's very cliche for me to say, and I have to say it again and again, the world today is much, much more connected than it was before. And then even if you look at 100 years ago, people probably think, oh, 100 years ago, there was no globalization. That assumption was wrong as well. Even if you look at 100 years ago, the world was much more connected already, or 1,000 years ago, if you look at history, the world had globalization, well, you know, back then as well. So I'm trying to say that today the world is more porous, like more connected than before, and people get the ideas and inspirations and information from many, many different channels. So, and then I think that's also a positive note in today's particular heightened political environment, that I think it's important to invest in individuals, and it's important to support individuals to do good things and these organizations, no matter how hard it is, because it will be up to these individuals to change a society into a true democracy, but not just, you know, we've all seen how democracy could be easily compromised by any people or in any, you know, established society.
I think that's a really, really important and good note to end on. So I wanted to thank you again for making time and for sharing your thoughts. I really enjoy following you and reading your thoughtful writing, and it was really nice listening to you. So yeah, thank you so much again.
Thank you for bearing with me.